Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico. Public Health New Mexico is a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. Last month, a decision by the Supreme Court in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby struck down part of the Affordable Care Act's mandate for employer-provided contraception coverage. What does this mean for New Mexico's residents? What impact could it have on businesses here? Joining us to talk about the Hobby Lobby ruling and its significance for New Mexico are Margaret Montoya, Professor Emerita at UNM Law School and visiting professor in the UNM Department of Family and Community Medicine, Paul Gessing, President of the Rio Grande Foundation, and Pamela Herndon, Executive Director of the Southwest Women's Law Center. Welcome to all of you. We also reached out to the New Mexico Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce, and the Association of Commerce and Industry, but they weren't able to join us this morning. So before we get started here, I think we should outline exactly what the Hobby Lobby ruling is. Margaret, can you summarize for us what the decision actually says before we get into it?
So, Ed, we need to clarify that we're talking about really a set of decisions that the Supreme Court made, because it decided on June 31st the Hobby Lobby case, which is a narrow decision, arguably narrow, and then promptly expanded it in the next 2 days. So we've got to begin with Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, which requires employers to provide preventive care to their employees, and as part of that, to provide contraceptive services without patient copays. And so people of religious faiths objected to that, and so there were accommodations that were made. And the question then becomes, who gets the accommodations? What Hobby Lobby decides is that closely held corporations also get the protection. That is, that for-profit corporations will also be given the right to exercise religion in a way that limits the access to contraception for their female employees. So I could expand on that, because actually the decision comes under what's called RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, rather than the Constitution. But what is important is that the decision that the court made applied to four forms of contraception. The next day it expanded it to 20, and then it expanded it yet again to make the accommodation that had been offered by the administration what the administration said was, well, okay, religious entities will only have to file a very short form that has basically three pieces of information and a signature in order to get out of this requirement. Wheaton College, a small school, comes forward and says, even if we file this form, that makes us complicit with these forms of contraception, and we refuse to do that. So the objection to the contraception is based on what is called a sincere religious belief that these types of contraception are abortifacients, which is scientifically and medically contested. And as evidence for that, I would cite you to the Catholic Reporter, which in February of 2012 had a news report that in fact stated fairly unequivocally that these forms of contraception are not abortifacients.
And what forms of contraception specifically are we talking about here?
So we're talking about the morning after pill. We're talking about Ella, which is another also form of post-intercourse contraception. And we're talking about two IUDs. And what is important about these is that these are very aggressive forms of contraception. And the IUDs are particularly effective because they're not needed every time that you engage in intercourse. They're permanently, they're placed into the uterus, and therefore are highly effective.
The justices said that this applies to closely held corporations, like you said. Can we give some examples here of some businesses in New Mexico that might be considered closely held Anyone want to take that?
Well, Hobby Lobby is actually here.
Of course, Hobby Lobby.
So that's a closely held business. And so what we were trying to do, Ed, just so you know, we were trying to see if we could get a list of the closely held businesses that were actually in New Mexico. So we called the Secretary of State's office to see if we could get some help there. But we couldn't get a list of those. So we can't give you an exact number of how many closely held businesses that we're talking about here. But you know what? I think that that's not going to be the issue as we continue to look at the development of this case, because the Supreme Court Justice Alito says that it's limited to closely held corporations, the actual truth of it, it's probably going to go a lot further than that. And that's the scary part of this decision. And so as we continue to talk about this case today, I mean, we're going to be looking at the far reaching aspects of this case, which is going to go far beyond closely held corporations, which were defined in the opinion as those with those corporations that had shareholders of five or fewer. And so, as we look at what happens with Wheaton College, as we look at what happens with other organizations that want to make a religious claim for making for having a reason for not accommodating maybe people of race, maybe people of different sexual origins, we are going to find that this case is going to have a far outreach that we never expected, and one that I don't think we want to see happen. So it's going to be important as we look forward. How do we get around this case? It started yesterday in the United States Congress. The bill failed. And the bill that I'm talking about is the Senate bill that would have put some curbs, to say the least, on the Hobby Lobby case, and that would have been not my boss's business. So, but we're going to hopefully see that bill come up again and see it pass.
Well, Paul, your organization advocates for limited government. What's your take on this? Do you think businesses should be able to make this kind of decision?
Well, I really wish that this system of health care and health insurance in our country did not exist. This is not the way we should be doing healthcare in the United States. Employers, and I agree with the two ladies on the panel, should not have a role in determining what kind of healthcare procedures are taken up by their employees. But that's because we've got this system that goes back, created by accident after World War II, where employers are given significant tax advantages for purchasing health care for their employees. And that's the kind of original sin of U.S. health care. I believe that individuals should be given the same tax treatment. And this isn't just me or the Rio Grande Foundation. This is a large number of broadly free market, but also centrist health care analysts who believe that this accidental system that we've created needs to be changed dramatically. Now, certainly some on the left will say, well, we need single payer. That'll solve everything. Well, I would counter that by saying that President Rick Perry might implement some of these same restrictions, and we could be back to square one, except for if it's the government controlling your health care, then you really don't have any options. I would take issue with one small thing that Margaret said. There are limits in terms of the advantages, getting your employer to pay for certain health care issues here, whereas you can still go buy a vast majority of these on the open market. You just don't get the tax advantage that your employer passes through to you. So these are still accessible options. They're just not being paid for in the same way. And that's the issue we're talking about.
Let me surprise myself by agreeing with Paul to this extent. It is definitely true that there are disadvantages to having employer-provided health care or health insurance. But it is a negotiated part of compensation. This is not a gift from employers. This is not employer beneficence. And yet the Supreme Court majority, the Republican conservative justices who decide this, make it seem as if though Hobby Lobby is engaging in some sort of act of charity towards their employees. In fact, this is compensation. And I fail to see why the analysis of the court doesn't extend to cash. Why shouldn't the employer be able to say, you cannot use the cash that I pay you to go and buy these forms of contraception because they offend my religious beliefs? It makes no logical sense. But I think that the other piece that we have to see is that there's something opportunistic about what happened with Hobby Lobby, because it provided at least two of these forms of contraception through 2012. It was on its formulary. And then it decided, because in fact it was solicited by attorneys to sue Obamacare to drop these forms of contraception. But there are other aspects to Hobby Lobby's practices that raise some questions. It invests its pensions with companies that make these medicines, and it buys heavily from China, which we know to engage in very disturbing abortive practices.
Well, we also want to hear from you out in the audience listening. Does this ruling impact you in a direct way? If you're a business owner, is this decision a step forward or backwards for you? You can call our local number, 277-5866, or toll free, 877-899-5866. You can also send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our webpage at kunm.org. And again, we did also reach out to the New Mexico Conference of Catholic Bishops and the Chamber of Commerce and the Association of Commerce and Industry, but they weren't able to make it this morning. So, you know, Paul, you mentioned that these medications are still available to women. It's not as if the Supreme Court barred, you know, access, that these aren't illegal medications now, but how expensive are they? I mean, what's the price barrier here? Justice Ginsburg wrote in her dissent that an IUD equals about the cost of a month's work for a minimum wage worker. So can we talk about the cost barriers?
Well, there were four that were not allowed under the Hobby Lobby under this decision. 16 are still available. I don't have price points on the four disallowed. Maybe my fellow panelists can help with that, what they would cost without insurance of any form. Given that two of them are IUDs, those involve a little more elaborate procedures than just taking, you know, the birth control pill or even the morning after pill, which are likely less costly.
Well, I agree with what you said about what Justice Ginsburg said. She did say that the IUD is about $1,000. I remind you that what the Affordable Care Act requires is that these forms of contraception be provided without a patient copay. But what is significant about this, what is significant about contraception, is that these are really about the economic health of families. You know, there is a perception out there that we need to be policing the use of contraception. There's something called the respectability politics of contraception as to, you know, is this really recreational sex? But we have to remember that women try to get pregnant for about 5 years of their lives and have to keep from getting pregnant for about 35 years. And that's all women. And for Latinas in New Mexico, this is a particularly important issue. Latinas get pregnant, 53% of Latinas are pregnant by age 20. This is a huge issue. We know that, in fact, the pregnancy statistics are coming down for Latinas, and families should be congratulated for this. Families are talking to their children about sex. They are not talking to their children about contraception. And that's why this case has ripples beyond Hobby Lobby. It has ripples beyond the women that are denied these forms of contraception. Contraception is really a debate. It's a discussion. It's a policy that affects the entire country. It's about boys and girls. It's about women being able to reach their maximum, both in education and employment, because they can control their fertility.
So Ed,
I need to jump in here for just a moment.
Please do. Go ahead.
I think that it's important to note that the four contraceptives that Hobby Lobby objected to were the most expensive that were on the list that were available to women through the Hobby Lobby insurance plan. And so if we take that a little bit further, what does that mean for women? So already, women were paying more for their insurance and more for their ability to get these contraceptives than men were paying. And so as we look at the statistics, we see that women are actually paying 68% more for their health care because of things that are involved, such as contraceptives, pregnancy, and those items. So when the Supreme Court determined, or rather that Hobby Lobby determined, that they were going to they wanted to object to these four major forms of contraceptives, they were really saying, okay, women, you're going to now have to go out and pay for these items. And so you're going to have to continue to reduce the amount of money that you're going to have available for yourself and for your family if these are the four types of contraceptives that you're going to have to use. And so it's important to note that the ability of women to participate equally in the economic and social life of this nation, it has been facilitated by their ability to control their reproductive lives. And one of the ways they control their reproductive lives is through contraceptives. Whatever the cost, and it's important, one last thing, Ed, for you to note, is that when the Affordable Care Act was formed, there was a carve-out, and we sort of talked about this a little bit, a carve-out to have preventative care, a preventative care section, particularly a section that would allow women to have coverage at no cost sharing. And so that means they don't pay for their contraceptives at all. And it's included in the cost of the health plan. Nothing is actually free. So we want to make sure that that point is well known. But still, once this carve out is made, women are going to have to pay more for their health insurance. Okay, Ed, go ahead.
Well, we got to take a short break and then come back. Paul, looks like you might have something to add here. But we're talking with Pamela Herndon, who works on issues of reproductive rights and economic justice, among other things, as the executive director of the Southwest Women's Law Center here in Albuquerque. Margaret Montoya, formerly a law professor working on issues of race, ethnicity, and gender at UNM Law School. She's now at the UNM Department of Family and Community Medicine. And Paul Gessing, president of the Rio Grande Foundation, where he works in support of limited government and on issues of healthcare and business. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to take your calls.
Support provided by New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where increased member participation in their not-for-profit financial cooperative has increased benefits. For a financial calculator and member benefit details, go to nmefcu.org.
The work of British artist Paulo Klein Uber is collected worldwide by luminaries from rock stars to sheikhs to Hollywood directors. His work is owned by MGM, ESPN, Bentley and Nestle, and hangs in the Berlin Museum of Contemporary Art. Paulo Klein Uber lives part of the year in New Mexico and generously donated a painting to KUNM as a raffle fundraiser. The painting, valued at $20,000, is titled English Green Wall. See a photo of the painting and purchase raffle tickets at KUNM.org.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. We're back talking about the Supreme Court's contraception ruling in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby. If you want to weigh in or ask a question of our panel, the number to call is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866. Locally in Albuquerque, toll free 877-899-5866. You can also send us a tweet at KUNM Health. So we left off talking about access to contraception and, you know, the price barriers that it costs, preventative care. You know, Paul, I'm interested to hear your response to this because you have the limited government perspective here. Do you agree with Pamela's summary there about access to preventative health care, and how do we work around that?
Well, Rio Grande Foundation is not an organization that has concerns one way or the other. We support people getting access to birth control of all types. We're not involved in that discussion. We're an economic-based organization. What I look at as a non-lawyer looking at the Supreme Court is that they jumped into the support of Obamacare as a law on a strangely worded 5-4 decision a couple years ago, and they're trying to artificially now come back and create some parameters on that law that maybe contradict things that are in the law. Now, granted, Congress did not explicitly provide for birth control in that law. It was added in the regulatory process. And I think that the courts are just trying to maybe cover back up some of the decisions that they've made here politically. It's a very messy process. I don't think the first decision was great. There were a lot of intellectual gymnastics to get where they are. And I'll be the first to admit that they went through a whole different set of gymnastics on this particular decision. The idea that a closely held corporation has different rights than other corporations, it is very artificial. So I'm not saying that the Supreme Court's hands are clean by any stretch. I think they're trying to even things out from their first decision on the Obamacare law.
Well, we got a lot of callers lined up, so let's go to Anthony in Albuquerque. Anthony, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just had some comments on some of the history of contraception that might be useful to some of your Christian listeners. One is that the fact that before 1930, all Christians would have agreed that contraception was morally unacceptable. And in fact, the Protestant reformers, Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin, had scathing disdain for contraception in all of its forms, more so than any of the language you would hear from any of our popes. Also, I would like to point out that PBS.org has a nice website on the history of contraception that your viewers might like to view. And also, I do have to object to the claim that some of the contraceptions are not abortifacient, because I just looked online at orthocyclin's product insert. It's a PDF, and at the very beginning it explains that one of the three ways that contraception works is by preventing implantation. So anybody using any of the common oral contraceptions are also relying on prevention of implantation for these pills to work.
All right. Well, thanks, Anthony, for that. A lot of perspective there. And, of course, that is the position that Hobby Lobby took, that these are abortifacients. There's a lot of disagreement on that fact. Let's go to an email quickly from Ashley. She identifies herself as a liberal, a feminist, and supports the Hobby Lobby ruling because it supports diversity in society. She'd rather pay for her own IUD than live in a country where people can't peacefully practice their religion. And next on the line is Bill from Los Lunas. Hi, Bill. You're on.
Yes, good morning. This issue should have been solved during the Bush administration. According to Rio Grande, why wasn't it? And also, since it wasn't, it becomes a wedge issue. So this wedge issue becomes against women, the war on women. The way it affects me is that I boycott these companies like Hobby Lobby, Papa John's Pizza, Home Depot. Papa John's Pizza couldn't give 15 cents each for each employee for health care, but yet they can hire multi-million professional football players for the commercials. That's how it affects me. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Well, the issue of poverty here does play in, I mean, to this ruling, doesn't it? Can you talk about, Margaret or Pamela, how this affects poor women, you know, in regards to access?
Well, the control of one's health, but certainly for women, that includes reproductive health, always impacts women with fewer resources in a different way than it does women with more resources. And I'm using resources because I'm talking about both education, money, and wealth. So these cases are not about wealthy women, educated women, because they have many more options. The weight of this case is really going to fall on teenagers. It's going to fall disproportionately on women of color and on working poor. Because they're the ones that really are looking to their health plans or looking to different kinds of health insurance for this kind of coverage. But can I say something else? Because I
Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
There's something that Paul said that I think all libertarians should be concerned about the way that the Supreme Court is using the First Amendment. Because not only in Citizens United did the conservative majority on the Supreme Court take the First Amendment and really torque it in a way that rips it from previous precedents. And we're seeing that now with religion, this conservative bloc of the Supreme Court is now using religion as a characteristic to create new divisions in the society. It is very problematic. So as an employee, do I now need to go and find out what the religious beliefs are of my husband, of my employer, in order to know what my insurance plan is going to contain or not contain? I mean, it creates a new division. It seems that we also have to now think more seriously about the religion of future justices, because religion is becoming, and they are describing it, as a lens through which we see all of our life. And it moves into the public spaces, where formerly religion had been pretty much cordoned off. With this decision, the Supreme Court is really talking about a new way of seeing the First Amendment.
Paul?
I did want to address one issue, is that, yes, this may disproportionately impact poor women, but under the law, this is a universal benefit, or was a universal benefit. So the law was written in a way that was very broad. Now, we could argue whether government policy should be giving these products to at a discounted rate or some way to lower income women. But that's not what the law said. The law did say all women. And in terms of the previous caller kind of alluded to this issue on the health reform and whether Bush should have done something. Yep, both sides have been complicit in perpetuating this perverse system where employers have a say in healthcare. I don't like it. I think it points, though, to a flaw in the healthcare law that passed under President Obama, that it reinforces that if the healthcare law had moved us away from employers being involved in our healthcare, we wouldn't have to have this religious discussion. We wouldn't have to have a discussion on what is an abortificant and what is not. That's something that really needs to be talked about seriously, because it also impacts the fiscal side and the affordability side of healthcare as well. Because anytime a third party is paying for something, they're not going to be as concerned about the quality, what is paid for, or the price tag as individuals are. So this is really about the law itself and how healthcare is paid for, in addition to some of these very important social issues.
So I think that it's important for us to take a stronger look at the way the Affordable Care Act is actually applied here. So it's not all on the burden of an employer. It's important to know that the way health care is being administered under the ACA, we had this whole reform under Medicaid, which allowed people who were, it doesn't matter whether they're employed or not, or how they're employed, they can get Medicaid coverage if their income doesn't exceed 133% of federal poverty level, and that's about $15,000 for a single person. And then as we continue to move up the ladder and above 133%, then the Affordable Care Act said, okay, employers, if you have less than 50 employees, then you don't have to pay, you do not have to provide health insurance for your employees. They can go out to what's called the health insurance exchange. Fortunately, the state did adopt that, and people can go out there and get that for themselves. Pick a plan that's best for them. Employers are able to provide health insurance for their employers because they are a larger group of individuals and they can get it at a lower cost. And so what we must keep in mind is that no matter where women fall, that they are going to be paying more for health care and for their contraceptive coverage if it's carved out of the health care process altogether. So that's an important point to note.
So then it's a pay equity issue, not just a health care issue.
It is a pay equity issue. And if you just take a look at where we are right now we have three congressional districts. In Congressional District 1, which is where Bernalillo County is, women are paid 85 cents on the dollar for every man. In the other two congressional districts, it's 77 cents to every dollar that a man is being paid. So you put that together with the fact that they're now going to have to pay more money for their contraceptives and for those women who need them, then it creates an unfair, inequitable arena for women. So that's important to note about this process.
All right, well, let's go to another phone call. We have Miriam on the line from Albuquerque. Hi, Miriam, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a physician here in Albuquerque, and there, and maybe this has been brought up before, but I just want to reiterate some other impacts of patients' lives that get affected when rules and laws like this are passed. One is that the types of birth controls that are being banned that Hobby Lobby is not using are often used for conditions that are completely unrelated to contraception. So things like endometriosis, adenomyosis, increased vaginal bleeding, we use these types of devices, and they are often the safest and most cost-effective ways to treat these conditions. And there's not a clause saying that if these devices are being used for methods other than contraception, they can be used. So we're basically taking a form of treatment away from women who really need these types of forms of treatment. And I don't think that there's been enough focus on that. And the other thing that I think is really important to note is that, from a doctor's standpoint, condoms and birth control, though popular forms of contraception, are notoriously unreliable, especially if not used correctly. And the types of birth control, particularly IUDs, are by far the type of birth control we encourage our patients to use because they're the most effective. And so not only are we limiting people's birth control options, we're taking away their most effective types of birth control for reasons completely unrelated to their health. And I think that needs to be addressed.
Well, that's a great perspective. And in your experience, Miriam, are there any recourses or alternatives that you can offer for your patients in that kind of situation?
So if you're talking about in the medical conditions, there are other sort of less effective methods that can be offered, but they're not standard of care. One of the things that, as doctors, we always strive to do for our patients is to provide them with what guidelines tell us are the best and most effective ways to treat people. And so basically what we start doing is giving people suboptimal care.
Thanks for your call, Miriam.
Thank you.
I think that's very important information that Miriam has offered, and thank you. And the caller that contradicted what I said about whether these forms of contraception are abortifacients needs to understand that there is a lag time between the time when the patient insert information is prepared, as well as medical websites and the most recent research. The most recent research has been reported in the New York Times and, as I said before, in the National Catholic Reporter. You can go, you can see that, in fact, scientists have been working to understand the way that these forms work, and they work by preventing ovulation rather than what was thought was that they worked by preventing implantation of the fertilized egg. That is no longer good medicine or good science. You can go and you can research this.
We're talking about the healthcare picture, and you know, it does play into medical care in this case. But also, you know, we touched on earlier the teen pregnancy issue in this state. The pregnancy rates among teenagers are falling in New Mexico, even though they're still way above the national average. There's a report last year from the state health department that said there's major disparities in teen births among different ethnic groups in New Mexico. So can you guys talk a little bit about what the potential impacts of this, of the access, you know, lack of access or having to go another way to get access to these contraception measures could have on our teen pregnancy rates here in New Mexico?
I think that we might be talking a little about a couple of different things here, Ed. I think that with respect to teenagers, more than likely the contraceptives that would be available to them would be available to them through the Medicaid program, more likely than not, or through one of the programs through the healthcare programs that are available at school. So I don't think that they're necessarily compatible in terms of the conversation between those teenagers and Hobby Lobby, unless we're looking at a situation where we have teenagers who are working for employers who might then try to raise the religious exemption for reasons not to provide contraceptive coverage.
I think that we also need to remember that the complaint that was filed by Hobby Lobby not only objected to these forms of contraception, but by any counseling or information that women might receive from their doctors. So when we look at actually what the complaint seeks to do, it is very broad. So that a doctor engage. So if you are covered by one of those health plans that limits these types of contraception, it can also potentially limit the information that doctors can provide.
You're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show live from the University of New Mexico. We're talking about the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby ruling and its impacts on New Mexico. Our guests are Pamela Herndon of the Southwest Women's Law Center, Paul Gessing of the Rio Grande Foundation, and Margaret Montoya of the UNM Law School and UNM Department of Family and Community Medicine. Do you think that a business owner should be able to limit access to medications? How is this ruling going to affect your community or your family? We want to hear from you. And if you want to weigh in to the conversation, the number to call is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866 locally. Toll free, 877-899-5866. Send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org or tweet at KUNM Health. We're going to take a short break. Be right back.
Grab your passport and take a trip around the globe during the Earth Day celebration at the ABQ Biopark on Saturday, April 26th. Visit the zoo, aquarium, botanic garden, or Tingley Beach and learn how to protect animals, grow plants, and go green. Come on your bike and use the Bike Valet. For details, call 311 or visit abqbiopark.com. A message from the tax-exempt City of Albuquerque Cultural Services Department.
It's the Chinook Spirit Children's Academy Grand Opening, a K-5 school where curriculum meets individuals. Chinook Spirit Children's Academy provides daily meditation, small class size, weekly service projects and field trips, nurturing math minds, passionate readers and writers, love of science, social studies, music, art, and PE. Financial aid available. Learn more at chinookspirit.org. That's C-H-I-N-O-O-K spirit.org. A message from the tax-exempt CSCA.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. Paul, when we left off, you were about to say something, and I had to cut you off for the break, so go ahead.
It's okay. I wanted to address something Pamela said about the pay inequity issue, and this is constantly brought up as a bigger issue than it is. And if you really take out differences of, you know, danger in employment, long-term, in constant being in the workforce between women and men, if you really equalize all the various factors, pay is relatively equal. I'm not saying it's 100% equal, but it's more like 96 or 97% of equal. And in my personal case, my wife was making more than me. Then she left the workforce, and we've had two children. And this is a very real issue. And birth control issues aside, you can't get outside the fact that women are the ones that have children, and ultimately, still in our society, mostly are responsible for caring for those children at younger ages. So there are a wide variety of issues that impact this so-called pay gap, and I just don't think it's as large of a gap as Pamela indicates. Now, obviously, child rearing and child care impact the whole birth control debate in other ways, but I just wanted to make sure that was put out there.
Well, in fact, if we look closely at the figures, the impact on women is probably even greater than the disparity that, that Pamela mentioned. We are the only developed country that does not provide subsidies for childcare and paid leave for women when they are having children. We could certainly go into more in depth on this, but I do think that the Hobby Lobby case directly impacts the burdens on women when they cannot control their fertility. And it has, and it is, it, we can monetize it. We can actually say it costs families this much when they have unplanned pregnancies. It has not only an impact on the woman, but on the entire family, and certainly on the New Mexico economy.
Well, let's go to a few calls and emails. Aaliyah sent an email saying she asked, what about Buddhists who oppose war or Muslims who practice Sharia law? Does the Hobby Lobby ruling open opportunities for them to practice what Aaliyah says is discrimination? So that's an interesting perspective. And then we have Abby on the line from Albuquerque. Go ahead, Abby.
Hi there. So I want to go back to what someone said about how all developed countries have these subsidies and have paid leave and maternity leave and everything like that. Also, I wanted to draw attention to the fact that for the NHS in the UK and the National Health Service, whatever that's called in France, and pretty much every developed country, Canada, Germany, most of the countries in the EU, the religion is completely cut out of that. In fact, the UK does have a state religion. It has Anglicanism as its state religion. And they don't have this religious involvement that we seem to have here in the United States, because someone pointed that out later, that that's been expanded and the First Amendment has been sort of abused almost in that way.
Thanks, Patricia.
So let me expand on that, because one of the things that happened this week is that a letter was sent to the president by 54 legal scholars, a letter that I signed, asking him to refrain from including this kind of a religious exemption in the executive order that he is contemplating signing that would provide for non-discrimination guarantees for LGBT employees of federal contractors. So what we're talking about here is that he can use his federal administrative executive power in order to limit discrimination against LGBT people. And last week, when the Hobby Lobby case was being debated, there were people of faith, religious people who came forward and began objecting to providing services. We have in New Mexico the case of the bakery that didn't want to provide cake for a same-sex marriage. These kinds of incursions into the marketplace based on religious belief. And it becomes, you know, really the parade of horribles when we in fact start thinking about all of the different kinds of exceptions that we could actually list when we talk about the kind of religious diversity that we have.
Well, there is a right to freedom of religion and religious expression in this country. So how do we reconcile then all this with the right to freedom of religious expression?
Well, in fact, RFRA tells us exactly how we reconcile that. So RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, was an attempt to balance what Sotomayor talks about, majoritarian democracy on the one hand and individual rights on the other. We know how to do that. We have done that, you know, as long as the Supreme Court has been interpreting the Free Exercise Clause. It is with Hobby Lobby that, in fact, the court really rips away those precedents and begins saying, no, in fact, we can really be much more, we can engage in this wheeling and dealing. And I agree with Justice Ginsburg that we do not yet know what the parameters of this decision are going to be. And it doesn't bode well for us as a democracy.
277-5866, the number to call to weigh in, or toll free 877-899-5866. We have Patricia on the line from Albuquerque. Patricia, you have a comment about religious objections.
Hi, yeah. Well, the first thing I want to say is I'm 60 years old and beyond childbearing years, but I do plan to increase my donations to Hobby Lobby. not to Hobby Lobby, to Planned Parenthood as the sort of protector of women's reproductive rights and providing reproductive rights for women across the country. And maybe they can, if they don't already have a program assisting women who can't afford their birth control, to pay for that for them through my donations. Also, I'd like to applaud the woman who sent an email and brought up the idea when I read an article about this recently, that does this ruling open the door for religious objection against war? And I think one of our defenses against this type of ruling is to poke holes in it and take it to the limit. And I know your panel is all specialists in reproductive rights for women, but I think this is an important issue, an important approach to take in fighting these types of decisions.
Thanks, Patricia. Well, what about that? Exemption, I mean, can you claim a religious exemption because you're opposed to war in this
Well, actually, if we use the example that Justice Sotomayor includes in her dissent, what she talks about is that it isn't so much the dissent, the conscientious objector who comes forward and says, I can't go to war. It's the conscientious objector that comes and says, not only can I not go to war, but you can't go and find someone in my place. And that is what Hobby Lobby is doing. That is what Wheaton College is doing. They are not only saying, well, I refuse to purchase those forms of contraception, but I won't even allow my insurance company or some other third provider to do so. That is the danger of the case.
We've got about 7 minutes left and a lot of calls to get to. Let's go to Mary in Albuquerque. Hello, Mary.
Hello. I just wanted to address the fact that within the population growth and the environment protection that we need to be looking at rather than the religious faith and their opinions, somewhere where we don't know where it is. And then also I wanted to address that birth control and abortions and, you know, operations to prevent birth should be free in this country. We should not have to pay for them because of the population growth. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mary.
You know, one of the things that we need to look at, Ed, as we look at this Hobby Lobby case, is what will be the far-reaching effects of this decision? What are the possibilities? So let's look at what just happened here in New Mexico. So there was recently a case called Elaine Photography. And so that case involved a photographer who refused to take the pictures of a gay couple and their marriage and make it memorable for them. So they raised public accommodations as one of the objections for taking that picture. But they also raised New Mexico's RFRA Act. So New Mexico also has one. So the question is going to become, what effect is that act now going to have on other operations within New Mexico? So it's important to note that the reason that these states there are 22 states, as a matter of fact, that have their own religious freedom acts because the Supreme Court refused to initially apply the federal act to the states. And so now what we're looking at, in addition to that Elaine Photography case, it's opened up a whole plethora of other cases that are about to hit the Supreme Court. One involves a case called Ingersoll versus Arlene's Flores. Another involves Craig versus Masterpiece Cake Shop. And then Baker versus Hands on Originals. And all of those involve areas pertaining to the LGBT community and the refusal to provide services to them. And one last thing I just want to point out to you is that just 10 years ago, a man by the name of, 5 years ago, a man by the name of Rand Paul, said, oh, I object to the 1964 Civil Rights Act because it prohibits private businesses and restaurants from discriminating against black people. So now we have this whole issue coming up with this religious exemption that could still come up to say, well, I want to discriminate against people who are black, maybe people who are LGBT, because it's now against my religious conviction. So instead of us complaining about this Hobby Lobby case, what we have to do next is to do something about it and work to make sure that our congressional leaders make a roundabout way to get around Hobby Lobby, because it's going to be destructive.
I want to see if we can get a call or two more in before we have to wrap up here. And Barbara is on the line from Albuquerque. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi. I just want to point out that it seems to me that the government's interest in health care is in providing the most possible options for medical care for any condition that anybody has. And so the idea that we're now restricting this based on religion through the government is ridiculous. And, you know, the government really does have an interest in providing options for health care to one of the more advanced, we like to think of ourselves as an advanced country. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. And Juan is on the line from Albuquerque. Hi, Juan.
Yeah, I just wanted to say real quick that I agree with the Supreme Court decision, and the reason why I agree with that. I think it kind of comes down to, you know, a person's right when they start a business, religious right, I guess, as, you know, stated in the Constitution, versus somebody else's right to get birth control. And I think if a person's forced, you know, through their business to pay for birth control, they don't have an option. Basically legally required at that point. And I think at this point, now that the Supreme Court has made this decision, that people or women that are seeking birth control still have an option. They still have an option. They can go pay for it themselves. They could probably go through organizations. But the other way, it's basically somebody's being forced to do something that's against their religious belief. And I think that's not right.
Thanks, Juan. Well, you know, here we are. this decision is now we have to deal with it. So, you know, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, there's a lot of diversity of opinion on that. You know, and one question that I do want to ask of you guys before we wrap up is, what if, you know, what options do women have now that may be in the workplace and find themselves unable to afford a contraception that they had planned on or need? Can you address that question?
So the option that women have right now is they can, of course, negotiate with an insurance company themselves to have contraceptive coverage. And so even right now, the RFRA does provide an accommodation for nonprofit corporations and now for closely held corporations so that individuals can go directly to the plan provider and to get that coverage. The question then becomes is how do those plan providers and those third-party administrators get reimbursed? So that becomes the bigger issue. But there are still ways that women can get their contraceptives. Again, they're going to have to pay for them. Why should they have to pay more for their health care? I just want to point out that at the beginning, my good friend Paul here snuck in that question about a President Perry. It's important for us to bring in, you know, what would it look like under President Clinton so that we were balancing it out. So there would be a weighing effect for health care for women. And I think that is important to look at that. There is an option. It just would cost them more.
Thanks, guys. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid we're out of time. A big topic, and I wish we had more time to talk about it. But I want to thank you all, our guests, Margaret Montoya, professor at UNM Department of Family.
Women can vote.
Women can vote.
Vote.
Department of Family and Community Medicine at UNM. Pamela Herndon is executive director of the Southwest Women's Law Center. And Paul Gessing is president of the Rio Grande Foundation. Thanks, guys, for joining us. If you missed part of this program or just want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Thanks to Jefferson White, our engineer today. Michael Hess manages our phones. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the McCune Foundation and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for listening.